Dear listener, welcome to the show.
What show? Viral.
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 I'm Lindsay.
I'm Megan.
And this is Viral.
Viral.
Welcome, dear listener.
Dear listener.
Do you know what we're talking about today?
I do. I've heard. There have been rumors.
Yeah, there have been rumors. I've seen some things on the boards.
Mm.
Well, we're going to talk about mistrust in public health, which I know no one has ever talked about before, so I'm really happy to bring it to everyone's attention today. And before we dive right in, let's set that olfactory mood.
Olfactory mood in Yankee Candle Corner. Okay, so today's scent during episode
54,
Public Health Distrust, we are going to be highlighting a candle scent called Christmas Eve.
But wait, Megan.
It's not Christmas.
It's not Christmas or Christmas Eve.
It is not. We are not in the holiday season at the moment. However, not only does this fragrance land, but I like that Christmas Eve is also rooted in deceit, lies, and distrust. Wait. Hot take, Santa's not real.
Whoa.
Trigger spoiler warning, Santa's not real. But widespread belief and or distrust.
She just spilled the tea.
Sure did. Okay, so Christmas Eve, top note, the initial impression, orange. Almond, ooh. Lime, lemon.
Yum.
White, right. Mid note, the main body, red berry, cinnamon, and nutmeg.
What is a red berry?
Red berry. It's the red ones. Yeah. Okay. Base, final impression. The lingering essence of Christmas Eve is violet, amber, creamy praline. You knew it was going to be a cream. Yeah. And vanilla. So Christmas Eve, to highlight the distrust we can legitimately feel in many of our institutions.
I believe that even though it says violet, I think it meant violent.
The inherent violence in the system.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like Christmas Eve.
Like Christmas Eve. Understood. Yeah. All right. We're there. All right.
Cool. Thank you for nose setting our journey today.
It's my pleasure.
It is filled with, the sense of mistrust and illusion, which I'm all about. We're going to talk about illusion in a future episode, aka drag.
Ooh,
so,
yeah.
But thank you for sharing the Christmas Eve candle.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Linz.
Yeah. Man, we could do a whole thing on Saturnalia.
The heart wants what the heart wants.
That's true. So, I like to believe that a little mistrust is not a bad thing when it comes to institutions.
Okay.
I think it's good to question, right? Because there have been many instances of government, private, and public institutions doing intentionally unethical, dangerous, and immoral activities.
Yes, sir.
That have hurt masses of people in the name of power and money.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So I'm just going to say, we're not here to be like blindly follow XYZ.
Yeah. Trust a bunch of shit. It's good for you.
No, it's good to question. So, public health is not immune to this. We will talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
We have a sordid history of human rights violations in the name of science and the betterment of society. So, I want to provide you all with a little bit of history.
We love it.
So, let's talk about,
let's do it,
the early roots of mistrust. So, because we're talking about history, we need to go back in time. I didn't know if you know how that's how history works.
Okay.
So we're going back. Our journey begins with a landmark case that laid the foundation for public health interventions.
What?
It's one that I love to talk about when I talk about public health to my undergrad students, and probably one that they roll their eyes at and don't remember. It is Jacobson versus Massachusetts.
Yes.
Bow, bow, bow.
Tell us.
In 1905, I am sure that I have talked about this case on this podcast in season one, but I love to come back to it because it's bonkers. This case, which was heard by the Supreme Court, which, by the way, during this time, Supreme Court was pretty small, and people were still kind of like, what does the Supreme Court do?
Hmm.
But It upheld the authority of states to enforce smallpox vaccination mandates.
We didn't have to go back that far.
We really did not have to go back that far, guys. So while this was extremely pivotal for public health, because it actually, it basically set the precedent that public health was not just about promotion and education, but it could also have enforcement powers.
Right.
Pretty big thing. However, it sowed a lot of seeds of mistrust, especially in communities that felt disproportionately targeted. Part of the reason that this case came to be and made its way to the Supreme Court was because there was a contingency of anti-vaxxers who at the time believed, oh my God, if you take this smallpox vaccine, which was derived from cowpox, that somehow we would like turn into cows or bad things would happen. So suffice to say, the anti-vax movement is not a new thing.
It seems to maintain its long-standing root in not science.
Yes. But that's part of the reason. You know, there was actually a church in Massachusetts that was like, no, we're not doing this, and started handing out pamphlets
about
how smallpox was going to turn us all into
cows.
And, yeah, so that's part of the reason it made its way to the Supreme Court. And I'm sure there's a lot of like even smaller cases in this regard, but let's talk about the Tuskegee syphilis study.
Oh boy.
So in the early 20th century, the infamous Tuskegee syphilis study cast a long shadow. So from 1932 to 1972,
unbelievable,
African-American men in Alabama were subjected to a study without their informed consent, leaving a lasting legacy of distrust among minority communities.
Yeah. And they also withheld penicillin even when they knew that it could support these men with their syphilis.
Yes. They did this in the name of trying to understand the long-term impacts of syphilis, which, of course, we now know that you can develop neurosyphilis and also it can be passed from mother to child if the mother is infected, causing congenital syphilis. So
this is some bullshit.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Yes.
This is a legitimate grounds for perpetual bullshit. Generational mistrust.
Yeah, and you know, you think about the Tuskegee syphilis study, we think about Henrietta Lacks, who had her cells stolen from her.
Yep.
And those HeLa cells changed the world. I mean, we were able to mass manufacture human cells in order to do testing during a time that was impossible.
Yeah, science fiction stuff.
Her cells went to the moon, and her family didn't know this until, like, I think it was the 90s. And it wasn't until recently that Johns Hopkins actually did something sort of about it. So fast forward to the mid-20th century, another dark chapter. Sorry, guys, this is, I know, not great.
Wow, yeah.
Black women, often without informed consent, were subjected to forced sterilizations and the use of birth control implants. This egregious violation of reproductive rights deepened the mistrust in public health interventions within the Black community. This also extended into Native communities. Native and Indigenous women were sterilized against their will. There are even instances where women with cognitive disabilities were sterilized against their will. So if you're interested in learning more about the reproductive justice movement and how it has impacted or how it has been informed by the experiences of Black and brown women, I really highly recommend reading the book Killing the Black Body. It talks a lot about, you know, when we think about reproductive justice, we're really talking about reproductive freedom in all of its spectrum, right?
Yep.
It's not just women being able to control their reproductive destiny in terms of not having children, but it's also creating conditions where you can have children and that it's safe, healthy, and you are supported by a system that's going to create a healthy family.
Right.
And I think a lot of times that part of the conversation gets left out because the conditions that currently don't support that have to do with the social and economic conditions that we see inequities in Black and brown communities.
Yeah, Yeah, and currently the bar is pretty low. Like, we just want, like, basic health care for reproductive rights among women and AFAB people,
right.
Let alone a socioeconomic system, right, that supports women, like, and birthing people and babies.
Right.
Like, that just seems like really some really hippie shit.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like, seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, hey, you know, fair wages, that's a reproductive justice issue.
Yeah,
access to health care. Clearly a reproductive justice issue.
Yeah.
Eliminating poverty, reproductive justice issue.
We ain't there.
We are certainly not there.
So, but all of these things you're talking about, though, also are, like, really recent.
Yeah.
Like, Jacobson v. Massachusetts, 1905, okay, not recent. But, like, sterilization without people's consent, Tuskegee, like, these are things that have happened within the lifetimes of many of the people who listen to this show, right? Like, this is like the 60s, the 70s. Yeah. These are not things that are in the distant past. These are real life implications for people who are alive today.
Yeah. And one of the things that stands out to me when I think about killing the black body is that up until recently, like the 90s and early aughts, we were covering women getting implants via Medicaid, but we were not covering them having the ability to get them removed. Women were basically...
These are breast implants, you
mean? No. Birth control implants.
Oh, birth control implants.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Hard left.
Which honestly, you know, you think about inserting an implant like that, and it's supposed to last, what is it, like 3 months or something like that. Anyway... and for some of them, they had really horrible side effects, and then doctors would refuse to take them out because, again, it's, we don't want you to have any kids because you're poor and this is going to impact you.
Wait, so help me, like, as somebody who doesn't need birth control because my sexual partners don't have semen for the most part. So this is a mechanism of birth control where they surgically insert a thing in your body.
Yeah.
And that was being covered right in your arm.
In your arm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and that was covered by insurance.
Yeah.
Medicaid. Okay. Medicaid was covering that. What they were not covering was
taking
the life cycle of that medical intervention. So they put it in, and then if something happened, they wouldn't put it, they wouldn't take it out.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
I know.
Who writes these fucking policies? Is it
people? Is it people with semen?
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
Yeah.
Okay, so bad news.
So we're going to diverge a little bit from birth control, and we're actually going to talk about maternal child health. So in the 1960s, there was another blow to public trust, this time involving the drug thalidomide. Are you all familiar with thalidomide?
No.
So,
oh God, is it going to be terrible?
Marketed as safe for pregnant women. A lot of women took thalidomide to help with morning sickness and nausea.
During pregnancy. Okay.
Thalidomide caused severe birth defects, like children were being born without limbs.
Ugh.
The delayed response from the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, in preventing its distribution eroded confidence in the regulatory processes meant to ensure public safety. This was a big deal. Women and families were so scared because these kids were being born without limbs and really severe birth defects.
Yeah, and this is we're also now in a space of, like, the sympathetic victim, right? It's not like, look, talking about, you know, Tuskegee in a hyper-racialized South, right, as something that was done against black bodies, which was consistent so in a socio-political structure, right, that allowed that. This is like, these are like ideal, quote, babies in a, you know, kind of racial society where white babies and white women are prioritized. We are now in a space of, like, uh-oh, even these white women are having babies that are really, really negatively affected by this drug.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember my mom would talk about, like, how scary that was.
So did they know that it was the drug, or were they just like, they didn't, I mean, it must've taken a while to figure out what it was.
It took them a minute to figure it out. Yeah. Scary.
Yeah.
It's really scary.
Yeah. So now again, like from a racial perspective, we have white folks who are also like, oh no, this can be really bad, right? It seems like you're seeing kind of waves of different people who are affected. You have the religious community, you have black and brown folks who have obviously a tragic history of distrust in our institutions mm-hmm. because they've earned it. And now moving into what I imagine were relatively wealthy white women.
If they, I mean, they certainly had access to healthcare to right. be able to pay for, right. you know, drugs and prenatal care, right? So let's talk about HIV/AIDS.
Oh, the gays.
The gays. So in the 1980s, we had the emergence of the HIV/AIDS crisis. So if you're not familiar with HIV/AIDS, HIV is the virus that causes AIDS. HIV is a human immunodeficiency virus.
Ooh.
AIDS is the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. So you can have HIV and not have AIDS, but you have to have HIV to have AIDS, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Check.
Check. So because we were seeing the, you know, most of the folks that were impacted by HIV being gay, men who have sex with men, or just people in the LGBTQ community.
Sure.
This definitely brought up issues around stigmatization and neglect because of homophobia.
Yeah.
And then if you happen to have other identities like being black or trans yeah, or, right. you know, there's all those things compound on top of each other. Unfortunately, during this time, public health messages were inconsistent. Many times they were, I would say, blaming, like victim blaming, sure. right? And a lot of times marginalized communities felt very abandoned. That's where you see the emergence of activist organizations yep. like ACT UP.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if did I show you that video of them putting a condom over a senator's house?
No.
What? You guys.
This is ACT UP?
Yes. Because this senator, I think, was in like Kansas or Missouri or something, and essentially was fighting against funding for HIV/AIDS treatment, research, all of that, because, you know, gay people are sinful.
Yeah, and it was God's this is curse God's, or something.
Yep, this
yeah.
is God's curse. So they stitched together a giant condom and literally put it on top of his house.
Dude, Larry Kramer was OG. He was out there.
Yeah. And it was basically like protect, you know, the U.S. from Senator so-and-so.
I love it.
It was amazing. I mean, yeah. it was amazing. They did all sorts of things, right? Like they were really trying to push the FDA to do more testing. You know, one of the first drugs that came on the market was AZT. AZT was actually a drug that had already been used, but it was off shelf. It had been used for cancer.
Mm.
And they started using AZT as a treatment, but it was really rough. It was really rough on a person's body. And that's where you see, if y'all have ever watched Dallas Buyers Club, even getting access to, you know, clinical drug trials, as well as other, you know, experimental drugs being used to potentially treat HIV/AIDS was really hard because of, you know, the lack of just motivation by the government to help marginalized people. You saw these membership clubs where people could pay to be a member and then they'd have access to medication.
For fuck's sake.
And again, like not all of those medications worked, right? And now, of course, we have amazing antiretroviral yeah. medication for people with HIV. People who have HIV die like everyone else now. Heart yeah. disease,
if,
stroke.
Have access.
If they have access, yes. So,
But I mean, that's important too, because we tend to, you and I, right? Mm-hmm. We think of public health, and I don't think of myself as a public actor, right? A part yeah. of the government. And I'm yeah. not. I work for a healthcare system. I work in the private sector.
Yeah.
Although healthcare gets a tremendous subsidy and
yes.
billions of dollars of tax deferment.
The government is the largest payer of healthcare in the United States,
right.
even though we don't have universal healthcare.
Yeah. Yeah, it's yeah. going very well. But right, as a public yeah. as a public health yeah. person, I don't think of myself. But we tend to think about public health a lot as something other than the government, right? Whereas this isn't all of these things that we're talking about are very much government actors doing public health. Mm-hmm. Like the HIV AIDS, like when that broke, that was Reagan's administration.
Yes.
It was fucking Reagan's administration.
And Reagan was like, don't care.
Yeah. And those, in the beginning, those people, and mostly those queer men, died because they weren't valued by the Reagan administration, yep. right? In the same way that black and brown bodies weren't valued by administrations.
Yeah.
And public health, right? Like, we have that legacy. I don't work for the government now, but the work that I do in public health certainly carries that legacy, right, yeah. of distrust in the government.
Yeah.
So how does public health, is public health something different? Like, we are not, I am not the government.
You're not, but, you know, the government has the power to enact policy, enforce policy, and fund public health interventions on a mass scale compared to private and nonprofit institutions. So I would say government with the big G, you know, is a powerful entity in enacting public health measures, right? I mean, we're going to talk about COVID. But, you know, and there's that through line, right? Anthony Fauci got his start as a infectious disease doctor during the HIV/AIDS crisis.
Mm.
And a lot of people were very upset with him because he held a very, again, a high-ranking position. And folks,
in Reagan's administration.
In Reagan's administration. And they were like, you are a doctor. This shouldn't be hard for you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, the math still maths.
Right. Your job is to reduce harm and take care of people. So, like, we always say this shouldn't be political, even though it is. Right? So, I mean, man, Dr. Fauci's been through it. He's got his start during the HIV/AIDS.
Yeah.
And I think he was with I think he's with NIH at that time. He's been through multiple crises, right? Where, you know, it's been highly stigmatized and he's had to make tough choices. And I think his work in the COVID pandemic was very much informed by his experience in the HIV/AIDS crisis. So, well, before we start talking about COVID, I do want to talk again about vaccines because, spoiler alert, a lot of government mistrust has come weirdly in the form of vaccines because we mandate vaccines. The government has policy that mandates vaccines, that makes vaccines very cheap to manufacture on a mass level, right? Because we know that herd immunity is really important. And in order to achieve herd immunity, you have to have a lot of people, you know, taking vaccines. So if y'all aren't aware, which I can't imagine you're not, but so notably, we had the MMR vaccine. And there was a doctor.
This is measles, mumps, rubella?
Yes. Dr. Wakefield, Andrew Wakefield. I think he actually ended up, I feel like he got his doctor's license revoked. But anyway, he basically claimed that there was a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. That was him. Despite many scientific consensuses and papers debunking this link, the narrative still persists. We still see things like, you know, organizations that advocate for different kinds of, vaccine policy, you know, that you should be able to opt out of getting vaccinated even if you don't have like a medical reason, right? And there's even a lot of, and this is something that even I personally have dealt with in my own family, not my own family, but I should say like within my family, is that some of the vaccines that were developed in the 1970s used fetal tissue from an aborted fetus in Sweden. And so a lot of religious people who are anti-choice will not take the vaccine because of it. Even though I would like to point out that the Pope said it was fine.
Oh, well.
The Vatican was like, it's not great, but dead children are worse.
Yeah.
From a preventable disease.
Yeah.
So I do want to put that out there. I see that being shared a lot. And of course, the link to autism, which there is no link to autism between the MMR vaccine and autism. And also, if you are willing to put your child at risk for a preventable disease that many of them will cause immense suffering, if you're more willing to put them at risk for that than having a child that is potentially autistic, you are an ableist.
Yeah, you might want to look into that.
You might want to take
curious,
a sec.
Get curious about yourself for a minute there.
Yeah.
But this is interesting, right? Because you have this, and I mean, this is, a lot of this is just like the logical fallacies, right? Yeah. So we believe this paper, right? Like we are, we trust, yeah, but like they don't care about the process, right? They like,
course.
They have a thing that reinforces what they want to believe.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter that the thing is the same currency of the government as like peer reviewed journal articles, right? Yeah. Like evidence. They're willing to use this evidence and eschew all other evidence, regardless of volume or merit. And it, so there's trust in what you want to believe. Like, I trust what I want to believe, and these are the things that reinforce that. And everything else I don't trust. But complete inconsistency, you get to grab whatever you want to trust and put it in your bag, and you get to step over whatever you don't.
Yeah. And I would say two things. One, when you put something out there, the amount of effort that it takes to debunk that thing is way more than actually putting the thing out there.
Oh, sure. Can unring the bell.
Yes, exactly. That's a great way of putting it. We also have to recognize that, yes, we have a peer review article system in place to make sure that we're not just putting things out there without other people that are in the field that are looking at this stuff and verifying it. However, that's not to say that that system is perfect. We are humans and we human.
And we are capitalists and we buy and pay for shit.
Exactly.
So like there are things that there are, for which there is a market always.
Yeah.
And the more salacious, the more outrageous, the more attention grabbing, the more marketable it is.
Yeah, exactly. And let's be real. I mean, how many of us were taught how to read a scientific paper?
Oh, God. Those are terrible classes, but I'm glad I have that skill.
Yeah, but not a lot. I mean, the science literacy in this country is not great. So, you know, yeah, if we can easily link one thing to another and make that through line palatable and easy to understand, it's way more believable than being like, well, there's a lot of gray areas and it's really complicated and there's all these like sciencey things and, you know, and unfortunately people are looking for those really easy things to use as a reason why something bad happened, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Which sucks.
It does.
Right? So then there's the COVID-19 pandemic.
So that was weird. I didn't like
just
that at all.
Little blip happened.
Yeah.
So we had the rapid development of vaccines, which, as we just said, people are already like, ooh, vaccines, don't really understand how it works, scary, and it's moving
cows
really fast.
Cows and fetuses.
Yeah, oh, it's using mRNA, and I don't understand. I haven't taken science since I was in eighth grade, but that sounds bad, you know? And then, of course, we've got all of the misinformation. We're not just going through a pandemic, but we're going through a pandemic with social media.
Yeah, oh,
which
Lord.
I felt like it was like playing whack-a-mole. Like trying to combat people putting like, I've heard that if you just drink like lemon water with, you know, a little bit of honey
cayenne.
And paprika. Yeah. Cayenne pepper.
Cayenne's always
it'll make that COVID go right away. Being like, no, Martha, that's not what's going on here. And it's like, you're willing to do that, but you're not willing to get a booster shot. Like what's happening here?
Yeah.
Just today, I was watching the news and they were talking about how we're seeing obviously now some of the effects of long COVID.
Mm, yep.
Which is honestly, we are just starting to understand it and it will be a very long time.
Yeah,
I think.
That's right.
But there has been some preliminary research that has shown that long COVID may be similar to a brain injury.
Oh God.
And if you think about it, you know, it deprives your oxygen of, or your brain of, it deprives your brain of oxygen, right? A lot of people had trouble breathing.
Mm.
You think about the fact that we lost our sense of taste.
That was so creepy.
That's a nervous system thing, guys. Like, so anyway.
That was creepy.
A lot of misinformation. And also, we are, we were doing science as this was happening.
Yeah,
right?
we're like fixing the plane as we're like on the runway.
Exactly. So people were like, well, why don't we have a vaccine? Why don't we understand what's going on? And it's like, well, one, science is underfunded. So there you go. Two, we are literally going through the scientific process of figuring this out as the pandemic is happening.
Yeah, from our homes, like without actually understanding how the quote scientists are going to do things safely.
Yeah.
Like, they also didn't want to get COVID and die of a thing that nobody understood. So, like, how do you make science safe for people to show up in labs and do together?
And I will be the first one to admit when COVID first, like, reared its ugly head, I remember everyone was buying face masks. And then there was shortages of PPE in the in the hospitals. And I remember saying, like, guys, think about why people, like, why does your surgeon wear a mask? It's to, like, not get you sick. If you're sick, wear the mask. But, like, don't take, you know, don't buy a bunch of PPE and, you know, deprive hospitals who are dealing with sick people all the time.
Yeah.
But then it was like, shit, people should have just been buying stuff regardless, right? Obviously, it's a supply chain issue, but whatever. But I remember thinking, like, ooh, I probably shouldn't have said that. You know, so it's even we were all learning about this at the same time.
Yep.
And it was trickling down. And then, of course, that gets interpreted differently depending on who's listening and who's putting it out there. So, you know, and of course, so we have the politicization of public health measures. We live in a state where the governor was like, businesses are more important than your grandparents not dying. So we're going to stay open.
Yes.
So that's
businesses are more important than your grandparents not dying. Hot take. Yeah.
And
let's put people on cruise ships still.
Yes. Also, we're not doing those COVID passports or whatever. And we also have a Surgeon General that is a COVID vaccine conspiracy theorist. So it's not great in the Sunshine State right now.
Yeah.
So, and COVID is still going on despite you know, everyone's saying that it's over. It's not. So, yeah. So all of these things have compounded on top of each other, right? We've got a long history of mistrust. And a lot of that just has to do with, I don't know, racism, homophobia.
Yeah.
But
a bullshit government.
A bullshit government.
The obfuscation of a capitalist government.
Yes. And a misalignment of priorities, right? Misalignment of, you know, what the real mission of public health is. That's not to say that there aren't good people in public health that are doing good things. I definitely don't want that to, there are lots of wonderful people that work in public health who are underpaid, under-resourced, who are changing lives every day. But, you know, when I think about public health, capital PH, you know, it's a systems failure, right?
Yeah, and it's also really hard. I mean, things are very, things are relatively easy for the most part in my household.
Sure.
Right? Or in my family of four. You know, 360 million people across the United States, the policy gets really hard. I also don't discount people who have spiritual, not religious, religious beliefs, I think it's, but like spiritual beliefs that govern the decisions they make and what they do with their body.
Yeah.
I actually have a lot of respect for people who live in, you know, in their spiritual walk. And it is, for the most part, we talk about this a lot in public health, is like really where we get caught up is harm to self and harm to others.
Yeah.
Grown-ass people can do grown-ass things.
Sure.
And I am like not here to really have an opinion about the decisions you make regarding your own body, good or bad. Right, like I just that seems like a lot of stress and a lot of responsibility. Yeah. I don't really care. You do you.
Yeah.
However, these are very much issues, right, where the decisions you make about your own body have deep implications to other people. And that is really hard. That is really, really hard at scale. And that's something that I think public health also has not been great about being honest about. There was a balance between health and economic viability during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think public health, I never thought public health was, quote, right in that shut everything down, nobody gets to leave their house space. Like, that only made sense for people whose houses continued to have food in them.
Exactly.
Right? There were millions of people for whom shut everything down, all economy grinds to a halt, didn't work. And yeah. public health, I don't think, had a good answer for that. There was nobody doing public health economics to say, okay, but like, there actually are risk ratios. There actually are sensitivity analysis. There are margins that we can talk about. There is a point where you have to weigh additional spread and potential lives lost against the implications of poverty in yeah. certain communities.
Yeah.
And and public health, I think, also doubled down and was like, health or nothing.
I agree. I mean, I would also say too, though, we don't live in a system that prioritizes health over economics, right? I mean, you look at a country
oh,
like,
sure, yeah.
you know what I mean? Like yeah. I think about Germany. The folks had stipend, like they didn't get just $700 a year, you know, for
also,
one time, you know, to somehow get them through, you know, the whole year of, you know, everything being shut down. They had essentially like a salary.
Yeah.
But their system is set up where there is a actual safety net.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And they could, and that system could be tested under the weight of something like this where there were mass amounts of people without a job.
Yep.
We are not set up for that because we love to penalize the poor, yeah. right? So if we're in a system where you get punished for being poor and then a pandemic happens and the economy grinds to a halt, yeah, it clearly didn't work out well.
Yeah, that's right. So, trust no one.
Trust no one. So where do we go from here?
Ooh.
Rebuilding trust in public health institutions, I believe, mm-hmm. requires transparency, inclusivity, mm-hmm. and acknowledging past mistakes. It also is really important to cultivate community partnerships and being vigilant in addressing systemic inequalities. I also think we need to be better communicators. We're doing a podcast. We're trying to help.
Talkie-talkie.
We talkie-talkie.
Yeah.
These are all a part of how we rebuild mistrust. And also just acknowledging that we're going to make mistakes.
Yeah.
We are all human and, you know, we're trying to do the very best that we can with the resources that we have. You know, I was hopeful that, I don't know, COVID would mean that the public health system would be a little bit more well-funded. That was a pipe dream.
are we not?
Yeah. We are held together by shoestrings, my friend. Wah, so, wah, and don't wah. Even get me started on the global public health system because it is rough. So, anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things you said that I think really struck with me is like, we kind of vacillate, you and I, across, I mean, huge global national perspective, right? Like the Reagan administration, Ooh. Like the Tuskegee, like. Yeah. I mean, big systems, well-funded, national level, about as far removed from local communities as you can get, right? Versus actually being in community, being with people, understanding what's right in community. And to me, if we think about rebuilding trust, it's like, that's it, right? Like, there are certainly levels at the federal level, at the state level, at the city level, at the county level, that we need to be aware of. Like, as policy yeah. people, we need to understand yeah. how resources flow.
Yeah.
And public health needs to be personal.
Yes.
And that's, I think, helpful. It's like, public health isn't actually a thing. Ain't no such thing, right? This is a story we tell ourselves about what people choose to pursue in life. We choose to pursue a world in which the alleviation of suffering can be done through the tools of public health. But that's just us, right? It's you. It's you and me. It's people in communities doing stuff. So I think understanding what needs to be done at the national level, like the rigors of science, asking better questions, right? Because we're bringing yeah. in more queer folks, more Black and brown folks, more Indigenous folks, mm-hmm. people who have technical skills and also ways of knowing that are rooted in their lives mm-hmm. and their experiences, and understanding how they can ask different questions at the high level, at the yeah. policy level, at the research level, and then how in communities we can apply those learnings in ways that are consistent with how communities want to live. Because it's just, man, it's different doing stuff on the south side of St. Pete, yeah. Florida, than it is on the south side of Jackson, Michigan.
Well, and I think it was you that taught me this concept of
targeted universalism.
Targeted universalism. Yeah. And how that if we can get down to the most marginalized, most the community and individuals that have the most barriers, and who are able to sit and say, how do we remove all those barriers? We're able to do that for everybody.
Yeah. Trickle up or something. I don't know how to say that.
Trickle up.
Trickle up. Like, yeah. Geyser up. Blow up.
Blow
no.
it up. No. That's not good.
Gurgle. Bubble. Bubble up.
Geyser.
Bubble up. I mean, bubble up doesn't sound terrible.
Oh,
it's effervescent-y.
Fun. It's very cute.
Oh, well.
But
that's my gift.
Yeah, that's
bubble
really
up for science.
It's really adorable. Yeah, bubble up for science. Love it. Love it. We still don't even really understand the structures of bubbles. Do you know that?
Wow.
I know. On that note. any closing remarks you'd like to provide?
I appreciate you bringing all this information to me. It was a good walk down jacked up memory lane.
I know.
Yeah, but we can do better. You're right.
We can do better. We can always do better. And
that's right.
I love that. I love what you said about public health is personal. It is personal.
Mm.
It from both a standpoint of we make decisions that not only impact our bodies, but impact our community,
yep.
but also that we should care about our community because we're in it.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's us.
Because it is us. Yeah.
Nope.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Viral. If you are interested in supporting us, you can always become a patron on Patreon.
Mm-hmm.
We also now have a Ko-fi.
What?
If you'd like to, you know, buy us a little cuppa, we'd really appreciate that. All of the funds that we get from Patreon and Ko-fi go to our amazing production and
handsome,
sound engineer. So handsome.
Thoughtful.
Mr. Michael Conrad.
Yep.
And Tyler.
Tyler.
Tofu.
Tofu.
I know. I was like.
Tyler.
Tyler and Tofu.
And Tofu.
Yes.
Those yahoos at the Kaboom Room.
Yes.
Making magic happen.
Yes. You can always find us on Spotify, iTunes, or any podcatcher around. We try to make sure that we are very accessible. And we also have a wonderful website, viral-pod.com.
Mm-hmm.
Please make sure you like and subscribe. It helps other people find us because we want to reach everybody's ears.
We're findable.
We are findable. You can findable us. We hope that you have a wonderful day.
Last day, folks.
Yes. And make sure you wash your hands.
Yep.